Hi folks, my name is Paul Kimball. This is the View 902 podcast. And my guest today is my good friend, historian, college professor, author, beer aficionado, Doctor Who nerd, and a modern day Aaron Burr. Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from dystopian Flint, Michigan, Aaron John Gullius. People are going to be wondering, what? I thought he said he was his friend. He just called him Aaron Burr. We were talking earlier, folks. We're both big fans, and I use fans in quotation marks of Aaron Burr.
Well, thanks, Paul. I appreciate that.
Well, I could have said you were a modern James Wilkinson.
That would be unconscionable.
Now, it's funny because I remember when I used to write my blog many years ago, there was a guy, I didn't know it was you, AJG was the handle he used. And I wrote a post and I compared some ufologists in some way to James Wilkinson. And you left a comment, which is still there somewhere. Best post ever or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you'd name drop James Wilkinson in a post on a UFO blog.
Yes.
And I thought, this guy's probably a historian.
I only knew about it because my roommate back at Hanover College, we had to do a big independent study sort of bachelor's degree thesis thing. And his was called Spaniards and Scoundrels, The Curious Career of James Wilkinson, and sort of an overview of some of the stuff. And so for a semester, my roommate was sort of living the James Wilkinson dream, you know, ordering microfilm from archives all over the place back when you had to do that sort of thing. So I just want people to call me Agent 13. So, you know, that's just my dream.
It's funny when people talk about, look at this. I like to call this my Bill Clinton pivot moment in these episodes, because I pivot. People like to talk about military whistleblowers as being the best possible UFO witnesses.
Well done.
And I always like to remind them, not every soldier is an honorable gentleman. And Custer's the obvious one.
Right.
But James Wilkinson is really the one that, if you're getting to the nitty-gritty, all you have to do is pull James Wilkinson out, say, go read about him, and then come back and tell me that every military witness is credible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a guy who basically placed bets against the survival of the country and started making deals with foreign powers to split off chunks of the West to be sort of independent countries under the thumb of Spain. And, you know, it's the one that always gets me is when they pull out the MacArthur quotes about we may all need to unite against an outer space enemy or some variation of that. And, you know, it's like, you know, I'm not sure if MacArthur ever listened to about 30% of everything he ever said, you know, in the public. You know, when he wasn't fighting wars very well, in many cases, he was in the business of being Douglas MacArthur, especially at the point in his career when he was supposedly saying things about outer space invasion. He's a clever guy. He saw what was in the news and he said, hey, I can work that into a speech, much like presidents and politicians and leaders have ever since. There's a certain segment out there, exopolitics, that likes to take the most offhand comments of anybody and turn it into just this massively out of proportion reaction, which once upon a time was really interesting to sort of watch and to sort of track these trends as they did. But after a while, really does get kind of exhausting. If you ever take an old cassette tape, and you make copy after copy after copy after copy after copy of a song that was recorded off the radio five generations before, the tape just begins to break down. It becomes unlistenable. And sort of these regurgitated stories of various whistleblowers and what did MacArthur or Reagan or Gorbachev really mean when they said this, that, or the other, it just becomes unbearable. And you long for something new, but nothing new comes.
The irony of you saying you long for something new after we've just spent 10 minutes talking about various aspects of history. You kids long for something new, but we're not going to talk about that. We're just going to talk about the good old days.
Oh, yeah. Because there's nothing new. We determined that.
It's true. And I'm impressed that instead of going with sort of a modern, technologically advanced cloning thing about if you keep cloning, each clone gets, you know, worse than the last one, you went right to cassette tapes.
Oh,
which,
man.
So 1984.
Man, my copy of Cream's Disraeli Gears that was copied 18 times on a cassette, when I heard it on CD finally years later, I was like, wow, this is revelatory. Where's the weird hissing and odd clicks and all the strange stuff I remember? I thought was part of the song.
I thought this was the greatest album of all time, but I'm not so sure anymore.
It's like, it's good. It's good, but it doesn't sound as recorded in the bottom of somebody's basement.
Exactly, and that's what I'm looking for in modern recording. Michael Jackson, the reason I never liked Michael Jackson is he sounded too slick. I needed some hisses, and I needed, you know, like, to hear a cat. What is that cat doing in my recording studio?
I need to hear the janitor emptying the trash in the background.
You finished for today, Mr. Jackson? Oh, I think I've... Oh, one of your gloves is in the trash can here. There's something sticky on it. Oh, wait, no, that's not a glove. Never mind, I'll just throw this out. Yeah, could you do that for me? Oh. People think I'm going to cut that out. I am not. So, it's like Al Bender, but not like Al Bender. That was not a Bill Clinton pivot. That was a W pivot. It's like Al Bender. Well, it's nothing like Al Bender, but let's just go talk about Al Bender then.
Clumsy but effective.
Exactly. Dick, anybody complains, shoot him in the face. Wow, it's hard to believe we're 8 years plus out of the Bush years, and we're still making fun of him.
I still make Gerald Ford jokes, so.
Also fair.
Actually, I make Franklin Pierce jokes.
Synchronicity, folks, I was literally just going to say there's nobody making Franklin Pierce jokes.
Hey, come to my class on Thursday. I'll be making lots of Franklin Pierce jokes.
I was thinking, I was going to, you know, as you were saying all that, I was thinking, what old president could I use? James Buchanan? No. Grover Cleveland? No. Ah, Franklin Pierce.
It's a good thing it worked out that way because I almost said John Tyler, you know, his accidency, which is the best presidential nickname ever.
My personal favorite is William Harrison, who gets pneumonia at his inauguration, and perhaps we can all hope that that might happen to another president someday in a couple of weeks. And, you know, he dies, what, 30 days or 40 days into his term?
Yeah. As a born and raised Hoosier, I must defend William Henry Harrison within reason, despite the fact that he wanted to bring slavery to the Northwest Territory and was not keen on the Native Americans. But I think if he'd lived, he would have been a much better president than John Tyler was. But unfortunately, they waited till he was on death's door to make him president.
Of all the presidents, his is the, I guess, saddest or whatever, because you know, he barely got out of the inauguration. Short of being assassinated or dying before you're inaugurated, Harrison is the worst case scenario for what a presidency can turn out into, because he never really got to be president. Oh, and by the way, just want to make sure that everybody listening understands this. We won the War of 1812. I'm just saying. Yes, you got the Battle of New Orleans, you got the final word in. But we won the War of 1812.
I think it was a draw.
No, the peace treaty had already been signed by the Battle of New Orleans. It's like scoring a touchdown after the buzzer rings. You know, doesn't count.
If you won, how come everything went back to the way it was before the war started? If you won, how come you got nothing?
I got news for you. In Canada, going back to the way things were before is the win. Because the loss is you guys take our whole country. So for the British and for Canadians, just managing to hold on to what we had was the win.
And, you know, I explain to students that, you know, one of the ways to define loss is failing to achieve your war aims. And in the War of 1812, our war aim was very stupidly to conquer Canada. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a good case to be made for it's a loss.
Here it is, folks. America's leading historian, Aaron Gullius, has just come out and said that Canada won the War of 1812. Finally, after all these years, we have settled that.
I am Genesee County's premier junior college history faculty.
We'll take it.
Except for the other guy.
How about this? Aaron Gullius, historian who's never been accused of Holocaust denial. Maybe we won't use that one.
Somebody's going to edit that to be Aaron Gullius, historian accused of Holocaust denial.
That somebody's going to be me. Wait, what happened? Hold on. The show just went off the rails, folks. No, I was talking about David Irving to somebody earlier today.
Oh,
so the Holocaust denying historians are on my mind right now.
You know, it's interesting. Somebody asked me if I cover Holocaust denial in my Holocaust class. And I said, you know what? The way I feel about it is, I don't feel obliged to bring it up any more than somebody teaching geology would have a day's lecture on flat earth believers.
Great way to put it.
If a student brings it up, I'll address it, but I'm not going to. And now we're going to talk about the people who say everything we talked about for the last 15 weeks either never happened or has been grossly exaggerated by the Zionist conspiracy. I don't engage it. One of my predecessors actually had a student tell her that he was taking the class because his dad was the local grand wizard, and he wanted to learn all the, quote, Jew lies.
Yikes.
He had to deal with that for a semester. And hey, Paracast Plus listeners, if you think this has nothing to do with UFOs, Google Ernst Zundel.
Yes, a point I've made many times that nobody listens anymore, or frankly, Google Jeff Renz.
Oh, God.
There is an undercurrent of anti-Semitism within ufology that people ignore at their peril. And it's there. It's still there. And it masquerades as different things. But Zundel is the most egregious example. Google Ernst Zundel and either UFOs or flying saucers. All sorts of fun. Good way to spend an afternoon.
Yep.
And so on that note, Al Bender.
Yes.
All Holocaust deniers are...
Archaic Holocaust deniers are put in the pit.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. So the East Coast Para Conference had you up this year in Nova Scotia for a talk. You were one of the featured, I think you were one of the featured presenters, and I was not.
Yes.
Whatever. You know.
You got a better room than I did.
It's true. I got a suite, and you just got a room. So Canadians know what really matters. And we won the War of 1812. And when you think about it, when I look at what's happening down there now, we also won the American Revolution. We just didn't realize it at the time.
It's a long game.
We're like China. We're playing the long game. So you gave a talk on the history of the Men in Black, which I think, and I'm not doing this just to shine you on or to suck up, because I don't have to. I talked to a lot of people afterwards. They really dug your lecture. And I know going in, you were sort of worried.
I was.
You had a great crowd. Everybody, I think there were some questions after, as
there,
I recall.
There were. There were a few. Some of the questions got actually asked to Bishop, because I guess we're both bald with facial hair. I don't know.
Well, I think you brought him in.
I did bring him in a little bit. Then they asked about some things that I had talked about or something. But I was like, oh. Then I thought, oh, well, at least I didn't have to answer a question. But yeah, I was a little nervous coming into it, because the more I looked at what I had, it wasn't a sort of Nick Redfern style, here is a catalog of really cool Men in Black stories. And I was really worried about that, because on the one hand, I was really worried about, you know, well, this isn't, you know, the standard convention catalog of cool Men in Black stories combined with some that you've already heard for sort of the, you know, the classic hits part of the set. You know, I was worried about that. And on the other hand, I was like, I couldn't do a Men in Black Greatest Hits Cool Stories compilation and have any sort of passion or feeling about it. And I realized that's going to show. So I focused largely on Al Bender, and sort of an odd way that was not part of what I wrote. As I was talking about Al Bender and his story, and I think one of the things I was really worried about were some of the documents I pulled in from the Gray Barker archives, you know, sort of looking at, you know, the development of the story. And as I was actually giving the talk, I began to get, you know, kind of emotional about Al Bender. I began to empathize with him greatly, this strange little man who people only really paid attention to when he talked about the Men in Black. Or rather, when he coyly refused to talk about the Men in Black.
Maybe we can just sort of unpack it for folks and say, you know, who was Al Bender? How did he figure into the Men in Black mythos? So give the condensed version, I guess, of your lecture, you know, the 5 or 10 minute version.
Sure.
Let's get into that, and I'll just let you run with this because that's what you're good at.
Okay, so basically, back in the early days of ufology, back when it was awesome. And what I mean by that was back before there was a universal consensus that what was being seen were structured craft built and piloted by creatures from another planet. Back when there was a lot more speculation, back when basically I need to do more research into this and more thinking about it, but there's a lot of overlap between the young people in early ufology and all these people at the time, Bender and Gray Barker and Jim Moseley and all these guys, these were guys in their early to mid 20s. These were people who are half my current age. And I'm not going to say they were like the Beats, but there was a group of young people who were sort of starting up organizations and starting up newsletters and contributing to each other's newsletters and magazines and sort of building a scene around this. It wasn't the contactee scene. It wasn't the Donald Kehoe, I'm going to go talk to my congressman scene. It was a scene of young people doing interesting, in some cases, thought experiments and theorizing about these craft in the sky. And one of these young people was a guy named Albert K. Bender, who was living in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he was in his 20s. He had been in the Army Air Force during World War II. He was a solid citizen, lived with his stepdad, worked at the Acme Shear Company, which I guess was one of America's leading scissor manufacturers, back before the Chinese stole all our scissor factories. And I'm sorry, I usually don't get political, but scissors really touch a nerve.
Depends on where you put them.
Could tell you some stories, my friend. So basically, Bender was a weird guy. He was a strange little guy, lived with his, and he was a kind of short guy. Lived with his stepfather, worked at this factory, and even before he was involved in UFOs, there was a story in the local paper, because he had taken the third floor of this house that he lived in with his stepfather, and he turned it into sort of a haunted house, chamber of horrors, occult nightmare, complete with records, with sound effects and people screaming, and he'd like to bring people from work by to show him the haunted house or the house of horrors, and he'd really sort of get excited when the young women from the factory would get nervous and get scared, which sounds so creepy and sad. But he was interested in these things, and he got interested in the UFO thing and started up an organization called the International Flying Saucer Bureau, which was one of the earliest organized flying saucer investigatory agencies. And he brought in some people from New England and the Northeast, guys like Dominic Lucchese and August Roberts, and also Gray Barker from down in West Virginia, who had sort of broken in by writing an article about the Flatwoods Monster for Palmer's Fate magazine. And I do realize that I might be sending some of you people off to the Wikipedia to figure out what some of this is, but Gray Barker gets involved, and Gray Barker was a sort of cinema promoter, ran a flying saucer magazine called The Saucerian himself, did some investigating, and this is all going pretty smoothly. The IFSB has got great membership numbers, supposedly. Things are going well. And then there's this cryptic sort of message in an issue of the Flying Saucer Bureau magazine. And it says, next month, an important message from the publisher. And next month, Bender says, the flying saucer mystery has been solved, dot, 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 in my favorite phrase in all of ufology, and maybe outside of sacred revealed scriptures, the coolest thing to have ever been written. We advise those engaged in saucer work to please be very cautious. So he clams up about it, and Barker and his friends try to figure out what's going on. Lucchese and Augie Roberts, they go visit him. They ask him questions. He says he was shut up by three official guys who made him swear on his honor as an American citizen that he would not reveal what he knew. Basically, he had figured out what the saucers were, and then the strange men showed up and shut him up. And the story first gets revealed to the public in Gray Barker's book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, which came out in, I think, 1956. And it remains my favorite UFO book to just reread. If you want to get a feel for what this sort of young person's scene was in the 50s, read They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And you'll see names that, you've probably read about in other books. You'll see Jim Moseley show up sort of as a weird, sinister kind of guy who you would never guess would end up being Gray Barker's best friend. You see Mead Lane, any people who are down with the Borderlands Sciences Research Foundation from the old days will know about Mead Lane. You'll see all these names. The upshot of They Knew Too Much is Barker sort of ends up by saying, we don't know who these guys were, but clearly somebody is worried enough about this that they are shutting people up. And so Bender kind of fades from the scene. And he comes back in the 60s and publishes his own version of the story called Flying Saucers and the Three Men. And it's published by Barker. And in my book, Extraterrestrials and the American Zeitgeist, about contactee movements, I talk about it a bit, that some people, like John Keel, for example, strongly believe that this book may have been inspired by Bender's stories, but Barker did a lot of heavy editing. And it's a strange story, because when we think of Men in Black, we think of government guys. And in Bender's telling, the three men were much more, they were alien. They were from the planet Kaik, spelled K-A-Z-I-K. And his story about the Men in Black turns basically into an almost typical contactee story, where he's taken back to the home planet. He's taken to their Antarctic base, again, some tie-ins with Ernst Zundel and some things like that. Whenever you have flying saucers in Antarctic bases, bad things happen. If you search around on the internet, on Internet Archive, there's a recording of Bender telling his story in a very nasally voice on a recording where he says things like, "Love on Kayak is free love," and then talks about how nobody's married, which is just, it's funny.
When we were in Liverpool, we went down to Shag Harbor, and I don't think Tim Benall really got it.
No, he did not. Poor guy.
And I was driving, so I had to pay attention, but you and Bishop, the first time you did your "love on Kayak is free love," and then for the rest of the weekend, Aaron did it most, Greg did it second most. I was like the bronze medalist in the 1500 meters in the Olympics. You know, I was like 40 feet behind, but I still got a medal. I did it. And Tim would just go, "What are you guys all talking about?" I don't think he did that impression once. But we were doing things like, "All donuts at Tim Hortons are free donuts."
and there's another line. If you listen to the recording, there's a line where Bender says, "I never got any money from you." The minute I got back from Nova Scotia, I went into that audio and I clipped that out. That is my text message notification to this day. And so I'll be sitting in meetings and all of a sudden, "I never got any money from you." And everybody sort of looks at me.
When is Paul coming to pick us up? At some point, everybody just, except for Tim, started talking like Al Bender about nothing. Like, is that a cat? It was a good weekend, folks. That's the kind of stuff. Come to the 2017 East Coast Bear Conference; you'll see the same thing.
It was one of the highlights of my year. So Bender, you know, he says, "I was told to shut up by three guys, and so I'm shutting up." And then 5-6 years later, he publishes this book, which vaguely tells the story of three men, but turns it into this weird alien thing. And then he makes one audio taped appearance at a UFO conference where he says, "Love on Cake is free love." Then he vanishes from the UFO scene together. Gets very involved in restorations of the soundtrack recordings of composer Max Steiner. Very involved in that scene. Moves to California. He's married by this point. He met a woman from England. They got married, and he never had anything to do with the UFO scene or the three men again. And much like pro wrestling, a ufological retirement that actually sticks is very, very rare. There are a lot of people who've said, "This is my exit from the scene. I am not going to be involved in ufology anymore." And then, you know, 6 weeks later, "I cannot sit idly by while so-and-so says such-and-such about this or that." You know, so these retirements tend not to stick.
I may have done that myself on 7,000 or 8,000 occasions.
I didn't want to say anything. Yeah, and actually, I was thinking about other people. But, you know, yeah, it stuck. And what's interesting is, and what I talked about in my presentation was, I'd been down to the Gray Barker archives at the Clarksburg Library in Clarksburg, West Virginia, where they have all of Gray Barker's papers and correspondence. And so I had access to all the letters between Bender and Barker. And there's some stuff that predates "They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers." It's really interesting where it really does mirror what Barker wrote in his book about, you know, we're going up to see Bender. We got some questions for him. He didn't want to answer them. He's being really cagey. But then after the book is published, there's this letter from Bender to Barker where he's saying, you know, "Everybody seems to be interested in the book. My supervisor wants to buy a copy of it here at the Scissor Factory. Have you been able to line up any interviews on radio or television for me?" And then there's this line that really always hits me. And he says, "It seems that since you got my book, I never hear from you anymore." And it always strikes me as just the saddest, loneliest thing ever. There's this guy who built this haunted house on the third floor of the house he was living in and invited people from work. And I have to think sort of pestered people from work to come see it. And they finally came to see it because they felt bad for the guy who was always kind of just the IFSB was his thing. And then for whatever reason, and old timers, you know, still debate this, you know, well, he ran out of money or this or that, for whatever reason, he wants to get out. And then when he gets out, he realizes that's where all his friends were, you know, Gray and Augie and Dom, they were, they were his friends, and he was important. He was the president of one of the most popular flying saucer organizations, literally, in the world at that time. And so he, I have to imagine, grudgingly gets back into it. And, you know, Barker had been pestering him for, you know, the Bender book about the Men in Black, because this will be another big seller. And then he does it. And then just from that letter, and that's about the last, I think that's the last letter I found in the files. You know, he's like, oh, gosh, Gray, I never hear from you anymore now that you got the book. And so it's kind of sad. But he had his wife and he had this Max Steiner music thing. And I get sad and then I realize, actually, this is really awesome. Al Bender will never disappear, because whenever anybody mentions the Men in Black, from the insipid movies to anything else, they're going to have to talk about Al Bender if they're being at all honest about it. And he has that notoriety, but at the same time, he got out. And not many people get out, you know?
Yeah, it's true. You know, it's like the Michael Corleone thing. I keep trying to get out, and they keep pulling me back in. And, you know, Al Bender's one of those guys who got out. Sort of like the Smiths. The Smiths are the one band that broke up and have never reformed and probably never will. And they kind of have an understanding that it was of a place and time. The relationship between Gray Barker and Al Bender, because Barker's a controversial character, an interesting character would be another way of putting it. Do you think Gray Barker was genuinely Al Bender's friend? Or do you think Gray Barker was using Al Bender for his own purposes? Or was there maybe a bit of both?
I think that 1952, 53, 54, I think all these guys were probably genuine pals and part of the scene. Once Bender left the field and gave Gray kind of enough to work with, but not enough to really make a breakthrough on stuff, I think Mosley has been quoted, or, you know, supposedly quoted by I think people like Keel in Jim Keith's casebook on the Men in Black, basically saying that after a point in the 50s, Barker simply didn't believe Bender, but knew that the story was good enough that he could run with it. I think at a certain point, this is not a judgment, this is just the way I see it, Gray Barker was a Carney-style huckster. You know, he was a promoter. He was the Vince McMahon of ufology. He knew how to push a good story, and if bringing back Al Bender after almost a decade of silence to publish a new book with the whole story of his experiences, yeah, I'm sure Gray would act like it was the good old days and like they were all just, you know, kids with their IFSB, you know, business cards or whatever. And then, you know, as soon as the book was done, just say, hey, you know, this doesn't seem to be getting the traction I thought it would, so I'm moving on to something else. I don't know enough to say if they were actually friends, but I think after a certain point, Gray's business instincts certainly took over.
Sure, and, you know, I'm not asking you as somebody who would travel back in time like the Peter Davis and Doctor Who and ask them, but, you know, you can make an historical judgment based on the record and the writings which you've read and everything. From everything I get from you, what you've just told me rings true to me, that they would have been friends early on, but then that would have changed, and that Barker used Bender as best he could to make as much money as he could, and when there was no longer any money to be made, then you get to those letters, well, why don't you guys call me anymore?
Yeah, that's a good summation. I think that he...
Which is a sad, not tragic, I mean...
It's not, no, it's not, no one died, you know.
But it's sad. From a human interest sort of story, you feel maybe a little sorry for Al Bender. So here's an interesting question for you then. Did he, and I guess maybe you already sort of answered this, but I'll ask the question directly. Do you think he had a good life? And by good life, I mean, do you think he was happy after he kind of got out of the UFO thing?
The records that exist are things that he was like the president of the Max Steiner Music Appreciation Society or whatever it was called. He was present when Max Steiner's Hollywood Walk of Fame star was put down. He did incredibly important work preserving these film scores, that these film soundtracks that would have been lost to movies from back in the 30s and 40s, And from what I understand, I think Bishop told me this, that he actually declined to be credited on some of the reissues of this Max Steiner music because he didn't want saucer people knowing anything about where he was or what he was doing. A lot of people didn't know he was doing any of this stuff till his, you know, till he died. You look at his obituary online, the funeral home's got the video, and it's got pictures of him and his wife, and they were married, you know, for decades and decades and decades. And, you know, he had this hobby that he loved and that he was recognized for as much as, and he could have been recognized much more, I think, if he would have been, you know, less of a deeply private person at that point. If you read Nick Redfern's book, he talks about Bender's experiences in terms of sort of repressed sexual desire, especially a scene in Flying Saucers and the Three Men, where the beautiful women from Kayak are rubbing him with some sort of gel under some sort of ultraviolet light to prevent him from ever getting cancer or something like that. And so Nick draws some parallels between Bender's experiences and other stories about repressed sexual stuff. And Jim Keith back in the 90s talked about the same sort of thing. I noticed that a lot of this went away, except for the book and his brief sort of comeback. He had gotten married. And I think regardless of whether or not whatever he experienced, and I cast no judgment on whether or not he experienced anything, but he found this woman, he fell in love, he got married, and suddenly the saucer craft just didn't seem as important, which is something I can absolutely identify with. You know, I honestly believe that Bender was better off for getting out.
Sure. Well, if you look at it, he outlived them all.
Yeah.
He just died, I just looked it up, March 29th, 2016.
Okay, so yeah, just this year, yeah.
Yeah, the Max Steiner Society, and he for years had lived, nobody remembered. They remembered the UFO stuff, but he was off the radar.
Yeah.
And, you know, he got to hang out with John Wayne and Vincent Price and these great Hollywood stars and his work with the Max Steiner Society. The pictures that you can see of him and his wife, they look happy, as much as you can tell anything from a picture. He reminds me, I'm going to use a musical example here because that's what I did earlier with the Smiths. Reminds me of a guy named Mark Hollis. Do you remember the band Talk Talk from the 90s?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You probably wouldn't have bands like Radiohead and all of that stuff that came afterwards without Talk Talk. Now, most people remember Talk Talk for It's My Life and that kind of new wave synth pop that they started with. But then Mark Hollis, who was the primary songwriter, literally took them in an entirely different direction, basically created the template that Radiohead and others would use years later. And then he released one solo album when Talk Talk broke up because of conflicts with the record company, because they were saying you're not making commercial music anymore. He released one solo album, which is wonderful, and then he left music altogether. One of the most influential recording artists in the 1990s, certainly, and nobody's heard from him since, really. Every now and then, rumors pop up, but no recorded music, as far as I know, and certainly no pop recorded music. He just left. And this sort of reminds me of Bender. Mark Hollis's main claim to fame would be Talk Talk. Bender's main claim to fame would be UFOs and the Men in Black. And yet both of them left those two things behind while they were still relatively young. And in Bender's case, never looked back. And in Mark Hollis's case, sadly, it seems like he's not looking back either. So, you know, there are those people that just do stuff like that, that they outgrow or they want to do something else in life or whatever it is. Sports stars are like that too, right? If you're Sandy Koufax, your fame is over when you're 30.
Yeah.
You'll never be more famous than that. So what do you do with the next 50, 60 years of your life? Well, you have to find something to do. So then you ask the question, was Sandy Koufax happier as a star baseball player? Or was he happier in the other 50 years of his life when he found other things to do? I don't know. That kind of thing always interests me.
Yeah.
Maybe because I did it myself. When I left my music career in the late 90s, I never went back. I literally went cold turkey. It was several years before I even picked up a guitar again. I went on and did something else. So, you know, sometimes you just sort of say, I'm done with that chapter in my life. And it looks like Bender, you know, it seems like Bender did that.
Yeah, I think he did. And I think if he were to look at, you know, and I don't know, I doubt he ever, if I were him, I wouldn't have looked seriously at what had become of the idea or the notion he launched decades later. I don't think he would, I think he would be sort of horrified and confused at just how the whole Men in Black thing took on a life of its own, starting with Kiel's Mothman prophecies, which, you know, honestly is sort of the root of when most people think of Men in Black stories they've heard. It's not Bender or Barker they're thinking of. It's John Kiel, right? It's the stuff that, yeah, the second wave. It's like that. And there was a question, I think, on the Paracast forums. I think, was it just the one question?
See, more synchronicity. I literally just called up the Paracast forums because I figured I should probably ask those questions. And then you mentioned it. So, dun-dun-dun.
Okay.
There's two now. So let's go with the first one. Then there's a new one, which actually is a cool one. So I'll ask that too. And then we'll wrap it up because you have class tomorrow and I have to go protest or something. First question from a guy named Greer's Meeting Planner. Are there any alleged whistleblowers who have come forward to say they were Men in Black or involved? And if so, what is their purpose? Do they operate in an agency?
Okay, so you had tipped me off to this question a couple days ago, so I was like, I gotta find that. I have no damn idea. So I did some checking around, and I was like, there's a couple of, you know, there's always allegations. Well, it's the Air Force, it's the CIA, it's the NSA. Found an interview on the very, very credible site called beforeitsnews.com, where somebody is interviewing Mr. Q, who is a former Man in Black. This is from back in 2012. And what interested me about this is because one, it's so clearly tied into the disclosure agenda. Maybe Greer's Meeting Planner has planned a meeting with Mr. Q at some point. But Mr. Q was tired of the lies of the government. Quote, it's time for disclosure. We are not alone. Basically, aliens control the American intelligence establishment. And the closest he gets to that is saying, quote, American intelligence. And the MIB is manipulate our emotions. And this guy fell in love. And so the MIBs couldn't, or the aliens couldn't control him anymore. So he quit being an MIB. But as far as agencies go, this is weird synchronicity stuff. So I'm reading this interview, thinking, well, this is a, you know, interesting story to answer this this question about, you know, Men in Black who've come forward and what agencies they might have belonged to. In keeping with traditional MIB lore that they are, and this is, I mean, I'm not one of these people who sort of gets on these sort of soapboxes, but there's this weird sort of racialized undertone to the MIB. They're Asiatic looking. They've got a yellow cast to their skin. So basically they're evil Fu Manchu types walking around. It's sort of out of the sort of 1920s silent movies. There's a journal article waiting to be written as the racialization of the Men in Black, but it's for somebody who's better at that than I am. But this guy, he says, you know, he's, the interviewer says, you look Asian or Filipino. And Mr. Q says, quote, we are an elite team from the South Pacific trained by an American intelligence agency. We were trained near and around the Kwajalein Atoll. I'm not disclosing any names of what intelligence agency is in control of the MIB program. And what caught my eye was the mention of Kwajalein. My dad was in the Navy between 1960 and 1964. He was an aircraft electronics tech, and he flew on, he was in the Navy for 4 years and never set foot on a ship. Flew out of naval air stations, and one of the stops on the routes on when he was a crew member on one of those big, they weren't the AWACS planes yet, but the sort of predecessor to the big antenna-based planes. One of their stops was Kwajalein. I had a Konica SLR camera that he bought on Kwajalein that I used to use. And what struck me about that was, one, I you very rarely hear Kwajalein mentioned in any context, but I saw Kwajalein, and the fact that the MIB were trained by an intelligence agency on Kwajalein, and what my mind went to was all the references to naval intelligence and the Navy being the U.S. branch of the military that is way more concerned with UFO stuff than the Air Force actually is. And then I remembered reading something in Bishop's new book, It Defies Language, about his encounters with the man named Mike Younger. And I think Younger mentioned the Office of Naval Intelligence being involved in things like that. And if any Art Bell fans are out there, Art had a guy named Victor who smuggled a tape out from Area 51, and supposedly the Office of Naval Intelligence was involved in that too. So I saw Kwajalein, and I remembered my dad in the Navy, you know, having some stopovers, like refueling stopovers in Kwajalein when he was there. And I was like, American intelligence agencies, Kwajalein, all these references to the Office of Naval Intelligence. Maybe there's something more here than meets the eye. And what might meet the eye is, this is sort of the secondary thing I always go to, is who is going to this website, giving this agency, dropping all these little hints about things that might not even be real? You know, there's always weird disinformation stuff going on. And so those things all sort of connected together. And if you want to know more about synchronicity, read Paul Kimball's book, The Other Side of Truth, where he goes into it in great erudite detail.
Sadly, or I guess not sadly for folks who want to read it, goodly, that's my Donald Trump word for today, goodly, it's bigly goodly, I actually posted it on the Paracast forums, that chapter on synchronicity, so folks can read it for free. Just sort of look up a thread that says synchronicity.
That is synchronous in itself.
So, okay, well, I guess that's sort of the answer to that question, which involves a nice little synchronistic thing.
To sort of answer Mr. Greer's appointment setter's question more, I don't know, succinctly or directly or in a manner as not to get me pilloried on the Paracast forums. Basically, any interviews or whistleblowing by Men in Black and any indication of what agency they might be from, and this is my honest opinion, has to be taken with an incredible amount of skepticism and investigation into who they are telling these stories to and why they might be telling these stories. I think there are agencies in the federal government who have things to hide and will spread stories and disinformation to confuse things, to muddy the waters, and they will tell them to whoever they need to tell them to make that happen. And for examples of how this sort of thing works, read Greg Bishop's Project Beta, which I recommend to everybody I meet, random strangers at the mall, things like that. More recently, if you look at an author named Robbie Graham, he's written some really good stuff about disinformation and former Blink 182 frontman Tom DeLonge's claims that he's being used to spread the truth about UFOs. I'm very skeptical of whistleblowers, in quotes, whistleblowers about the UFO thing, because there are numerous examples of them being used as conduits for misinformation and disinformation. So if a Man in Black were to become a whistleblower and tell us everything he knew, I would immediately wonder what they're trying to get me to not look at.
True, with the possible exception, actually I think with the actual exception of two. Wild Bill Cooper, totally legit, completely 100% legit, and anyone who's ever talked to Rich Dolan.
Are you drunk or am I, Paul? Because that doesn't make a damn bit of sense.
It's like when two different Doctor Whos meet. What just happened? The Peter Davison Doctor Who just met the Matt Smith Doctor Who. Ooh.
It's like the episode where the Brigadier meets himself and the Blinovich limitation effect shorts everything out.
That's exactly what it's like without being like that, but completely like that.
That is a deep cut, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, right there. Very, very deep Doctor Who weirdness.
Modern Undead, 1983.
All right, so one last question before you wander off to the Land of Nod, because you have to teach tomorrow. This one just came in from a guy known as James Style, and that's all one word. And he writes, no idea if this question is appropriate for this guest. So that's always a good way to start. But what factors aside, and he puts aside in capital letters, so what factors aside from intolerance of uncertainty influence most paranormal researchers, fans, to crave a nuts and bolts explanation to UFO and related phenomenon? And then he offers a couple of examples. Heuristic-inspired laziness, satisfying childhood wonder, and dot, dot, dot. So
the nuts and bolts approach to ufology, I think, is the most limiting and boring way to look at the phenomenon. But as far as why that approach would be taken and why it's so popular and why in a lot of ways it's become the dominant paradigm, I think there are ways to look at it that we don't necessarily need to denigrate those who take that approach. I think one of the attractive things about that theory is that unlike ideas about consciousness or interdimensionality, or conjured up thought forms or any of the other things that actually I find pretty interesting. I think the nuts and bolts aspect carries with it the tantalizing possibility of proof, which, you know, the entire notion of proof is part of this rationalist construct that the nuts and bolts thing lives in, right? But if you're looking for these nuts and bolts things, if you can have a part, if you can have some readings, if you can have some data, you can analyze it. And if you have something that, as nuts and bolts do, conforms to the physical laws as are currently accepted by credentialed experts, then you can get some validation from those credentialed experts and from the establishment in general. And as much as, or as little as I think that's, you know, interesting or important, there are those involved in research for whom that kind of, I'm not going to use the term mainstream, because I think that's become pejoratified and stretched out of proportion. But for accepted credentialed scientists to be able to say, well, golly, there is no way we can refute that this is, you know, something that we need to take seriously because we have seen the data, or we have seen the part, or we have seen the material, and this bears further investigation. I think what it comes from is, you know, not necessarily from wanting a sense of childlike wonder to be fulfilled. For another thing, I think fulfilling childlike senses of wonder is one of the hallmarks that you've really become an adult, right? But I think there's a generational aspect of this, and for the older generation, there is a craving for credibility and acceptance that is more attractive when you've had decades of being dismissed and ridiculed. And I think, to sort of turn things on its head, why would somebody cleave to non-physical, non-nuts and bolts explanations of the phenomenon if it wasn't for their pathological desire to be seen as being different or special or unable to be proved wrong because it's all about consciousness? Now, you can sort of flip these things on their head, right? It's easy to make one's own worldview to sort of come to the conclusion that that's the default and everybody else clearly has something wrong with them. But I think the nuts and bolts people are, the nice thing about nuts and bolts stuff is if you have a nut or a bolt, somebody can run some tests on it and say, nope, this was made in Akron, not Zeta Reticuli. Same thing. It was years and years ago, the one time I was on Banal of America, and he asked me, I think something like, if I consider cryptozoology to be paranormal. And I said, you know, not really, because if somebody finds a piece of what they think is Bigfoot, we can run some tests on that. You know, unknown creatures, we just have to find them and come to know them. You know, it's not necessarily a paranormal thing. It's sort of the paranormal thing that has the potential to be proven. But I don't know if that whole thing is a good answer or not. But
I think so. It's sort of the same thing with ghost quotation marks hunting, right? So there's two ways of looking at it. There's the way that Holly and I more or less did it on ghost cases, which was not universally popular. I've read the reviews on Amazon.com. Some people got it, some people didn't. Where we tried a more experiential thing. Yes, we had the tape recorders every now and then and the cameras, but mostly it was, could we have an experience? And then there's ghost hunters. Ghost Hunters is out there doing a terrible job and probably faking things, but looking for alleged proof. So everything for them is about the tech. To me, the tech is the equivalent of the ETH and what you just talked about. Proof. Something we can physically, tangibly, like, it's easy for us to grasp. It's a lot harder to grasp the kind of things that Holly and I experienced, say, in the Shocklack Cemetery in England, which I put the episode up online. Somebody wrote, I think, on the Paracast forum, so there's no proof of anything happening. You didn't record anything. You didn't get anything on camera. A ghost didn't walk up to you and say hello. It's just all of us that were in that cemetery that night. We experienced things. All we can do is tell you about them because if you can go to the cemetery, you might experience things yourself. In fact, there's now three guys that are going to drive down from Scotland to go there.
Nice.
And I said, yes, great part of the country, border of Wales, plus really freaky. Go there at dusk and see what happens to you. But, you know, it also comes back to the idea, and I was sort of thinking of this maybe to close it out. And I have conversations with a very old friend of mine, my sort of business partner, Ron Foley McDonald, who knows far more about music than I ever will. And he will pick me up, we'll go see a movie or something, and he's always listening to Miles Davis. And I say to him, hey, Ron, jokingly now, because I know this just annoys him, that doesn't sound like Ornette Coleman. And for folks who don't know who Ornette Coleman was, he was probably the seminal founder of avant-garde jazz. I would strongly suggest you search out his 1959 album, The Shape of Jazz to Come. So if you're Kenny G, Miles Davis is freaky. But if you're Miles Davis, so Kenny G is the ETH, I guess.
That's the, I love that.
But if you're so Miles Davis, those kind of people look down on Kenny G. But it's a continuum, right? So say Miles Davis is the EDH. So he's the Jacques Vallée in EDH, extra dimensional hypothesis. Well, Ornette Coleman is the consciousness thing. He's the one that maybe Bishop and me and Tony's and some others, we went out on that limb. And it's all relative. And as Miles Davis once said about Ornette Coleman, man, white people will listen to anything.
We absolutely will.
And Kenny G probably said the exact same thing about Miles Davis.
Yeah.
So it's all relative to me. Why somebody latches on to something like Kenny G or the ETH or why they go down the Jacques Vallée road, that it's very idiosyncratic. It's what kind of music, and in this case the theories are music, play to you. And that, to me, is usually related to a whole host of factors, your upbringing, what you've experienced, that make it very hard to unpack and find one very simple answer to that question. And I think you did a pretty good job of trying to do that. But then it leads back to the idea that if the paranormal is real and interacting with us, maybe it treats us all individually. So it's a very personal, and it's kind of that religious thing where mm-hmm. it's the direct interaction with God. Who needs priests? We can talk to God directly. And so maybe it interacts with us differently, though. For one person, they're hearing Ornette Coleman, and for another person, they're hearing Kenny G. But it's the same thing.
Yeah, that I like what you bring up about, you know, the experiences and the interests sort of relating to the background as someone who has, you know, who's always, you know, had strong sort of very conventional religious faith and not good at science but finding it interesting. The nuts and bolts stuff to me is much less interesting than the sort of consciousness and metaphysical aspects to all these phenomena and how it's all part of the idea of a sort of divine order. You know, these things all belong, you know, and not all of them can be explained. And not all of them should be explained. In trying to explain it, you misunderstand what they're about. It's easy to get bogged down in nuts and bolts.
And in trying to explain it, as you just pointed out, oftentimes we sort of miss the understanding of what's really going on.
Yeah.
So, maybe this is what I'll title the episode. You see the trees, but you don't actually realize you're standing in the middle of a forest.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it all interesting, I think, at the end of the day. And this, here's the Bill Clinton pivot, is the end of the day, which is to say the end of the episode. That is the Ornette Coleman version of a UFO podcast. There you go.
It's really a typical Gullius Kimball experience, really.
It is. And I think we should start a podcast band called the Gullius Kimball Bishop Experience.
I would be totally down with that. Every week we would have to say, well, really, it's kind of a concept album.
Exactly. Or is it a con album?
Well,
ooh.
as both a Rush and Jethro Tull fan, I can say it's a con. Yeah, I just bought Jethro Tull's Passion Play on heavyweight vinyl this weekend. So,
oh Jesus, that's right. You're a Rush fan. Oh.
You know, I've only seen them once live, because, and it turns out it's probably the last time I would ever have an opportunity. So. I got to see some people at the Palace of Auburn Hills busted for smoking pot at the concert. I got to see Neil Peart drum without one of his arms falling off. You know, I got to hear Geddy Lee finally sing low enough that I could sing along because his voice is shot. But, you know, it's yeah, I know.
You know how I know that we won the War of 1812? Because Captain Kirk is a Canadian. We convinced you that Rush is actually something useful musically and it's good music. And Donald Trump was born in Saskatchewan, so your next president is a Canadian.
Wait, what?
My guest has been Aaron John Gullius, who will soon be living under the Canadian president, Donald J. Trump. And we'll catch you next time. Here's some Ornette Coleman to take you out for the evening.